This afternoon on In Depth with Francis Rose, one of the most important sets of eyeballs on your agency's FITARA implementation plans will be the Government Accountability Office's. Dave Pounder, the GAO, tells you what he'll look for. And having a cybersecurity dashboard is great, but what really matters is what's on the dashboard. Former EPA CIO Molly O'Neill lists the must-haves. That and lots more on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Some stories are best told through pictures. Check out our Fed Photos of the Day gallery for a different perspective on the federal community. Find it on our homepage, federalnewsradio.com.
Welcome to Ask the Chief Information Officer on Federal News Radio. Every week, Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller interviews CIOs of federal agencies about the latest directives, IT challenges, and successes. Now, your host, Jason Miller.
My guest today is David Bray, the Federal Communication Commission's Chief Information Officer. David, in many ways, this is a return engagement for you. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
So let's just start at the beginning. It's been about 18 months since you've been on my program, and lots been going on. I've seen you speak several times, but there's a lot of older priorities we should start with because I think you're always kind of moving forward on different things. So let's catch up on a few things. Let's start back in 2014 when you're on the show. You mentioned customer service entrepreneurs, and that's an IN instead of EN. Talk about, did that ever happen? And if so, what kind of effect are they having? And how are you dealing with that internal customer service challenge?
The entrepreneurs were rolled out. So entrepreneurs are entrepreneurs on the inside. And basically, they're the liaison between what we're doing in terms of IT at the FCC and the mission focus of the Bureau and offices. And we have 18 different bureaus and offices at the FCC. They each have different foci in terms of the mission priorities they're looking at, as well as just different cultures. And so we've been very successful with the bottom up to just get a better understanding of what is needed across the different efforts at the FCC. We've also embraced the concept of change agents. So beyond just the entrepreneurs serving as a sort of liaisons to what we're doing, there's the idea of change agents, which is really the idea that anybody can come and pitch an idea. Doesn't even have to be inside the IT team, although a lot of them are. And as a change agent, if you make a recommendation as to what we could do better to serve the public better, to do IT better, I usually ask three questions, which is first, give me three reasons why we should do this. Then give me three reasons as to why we shouldn't or what would go wrong. And then after you give me those three reasons as to why we shouldn't do it or what would go wrong, give me three reasons to mitigate it. And if someone has a reason to do that and they have the actual sort of thought it through in terms of both why we should do it as well as what might be going wrong, then we run it as sort of a very small experiment. Usually it's a no more than 6 months experiment. And I'm sort of seeing my role as CIO as being sort of that internal venture capitalist.
What kind of ideas have come? Give me an example or two.
So probably the best example of what we've had with a change agent was we were looking at updating our 15-year-old consumer help desk. The site had been around for 15 years. You had to literally download one of 18 different PDFs, or the FCC would mail them to you. You'd fill them out. You'd send them back by postal mail, and then we'd scan them. And, you know, that's not how it should be nowadays. So we were looking at updating to a modern web system to do for our consumer help desk. And the quotes we were getting both from existing government agencies that had done this as well as the private sector was anywhere between $3.2 million on up to do it on-premise and anywhere between 18 and 24 months to get it done. One of our change agents here at the FCC said, well, wait, instead of doing it on-premise, why don't we do it as a software-as-a-service option? And so we looked at it, and we actually decided to invest in a software-as-a-service option. That meant instead of it being $3.2 million, it was only $450,000, so one-sixth the cost. And instead of taking 18 to 24 months, it was done in less than 6 months, so less than half the time, in fact, one-third the time. And what was even more impressive was about 6 months after we rolled it out, there was a Forbes article we didn't even know was coming that actually was an article in which the writer said how the FCC saved me $1,800. And basically they said because the system was so easy to use and so transparent, they were able to resolve a concern in less than 4 days.
Now, if that's a story you've told many times because I think it's a great example. Do you see an ebb and flow to the change agents? Do you get some ideas that are just head scratchers for you going, okay, they can't answer my questions and this just doesn't seem working? Do you get others that you just don't have the resources to do?
Yeah, so there are several cases where we just don't have the resources to do. So oftentimes it's prioritization of things in the queue. Generally, if I ever get a head scratcher, I often say to them, well, let's work on this together. So I don't want them to just come and feel like, you know, they haven't had all the answers yet. Usually where people and change agents hit the biggest barrier is they've got three great reasons why we should do something, but they don't have three reasons why we shouldn't. And I think that is like that second and third order thinking that's necessary. or they've got three reasons where like, well, maybe this, maybe that, but it's not really fleshed out. And so that's where I'll say, well, let's revisit this. How about you go offline and we come back a week later and let's talk about who actually would be the reasons that we might want to, or who or what would be the reasons why we wouldn't want to do this? And then from that, how would we actually come up with a strategy? Would we involve them earlier? Would we involve them more often? When we're looking at the FCC website, of course, the website, we are doing a refresh on the content. We know that there are different user bases that use the website. So, for example, our one solution to the change agent effort there was to involve stakeholders early and often, and also to use a scientific approach when we're involving their inputs. So oftentimes you get people that, you know, they want to do website by committee, which is the last thing we want to do is a website by committee. So we actually use science as well as card sorting on the part of the different stakeholder user groups so that everyone had a voice, and then it was prioritization of the things we focus on first.
Are you able to take a portion of your IT budget and put it towards these type of change agents? Because, again, it's easy to say, well, that'd be nice if... Then you end up in this bigger queue, longer queue, and you get a lot of little things done, but maybe not the big thing that could have the major difference.
When we go through the capital planning and investment control process, CPIC, if a change agent is backing it, that gives it more priority. And so that's one method in which we do it. Again, we don't really have a lot of flexible funds. Our budget is pretty tight. But if it is something where the change agent can show that if we invest in this now, we won't have to spend as much in terms of O&M, operations and maintenance. So the example of the consumer help desk, part of the pitch there was if we continue to do what we were doing, it was going to cost us $600,000 a year just to maintain things on site. Whereas if we went to a software as a service option, it was going to be only $100,000. So if you play that over 5 years, we're going to save $2.5 million. That's where I was then able to say, no brainer, let's go forth and do it. So oftentimes, even if we don't necessarily have the funds available to be as free as I would like to be as an internal venture capitalist on the inside, if someone can make the pitch that if we invest in this now, we won't have to spend more money later, then we're willing to do that.
One other thing about this is you're empowering people to bring you ideas and not just saying, okay, great idea, move on, but empowering them to also to see, oh, well, if I come up with an idea, then it becomes real, then it becomes, so other people will see it. I mean, is that part of the culture change that you're pushing toward?
Yes. I'm intentional in saying I want to reward creative problem solvers. So don't just bring me a problem or don't just bring me an idea, but bring me something that you can actually, if I invest in you, you can actually see to fruition. And then along the way, I'm actually very intentional about using my online social media presence with FCC_CIO on Twitter to give thanks to the team members. In fact, just a week ago, I went through the list of the different change agents we had. It was about 15. And actually thanked each one of them specifically for the things they did.
I think it's a great example of how, again, looking for little things, get bottom up, and then pushing the top down to make it work and make a big difference. Let me shift to another older priority. At that time, it was you guys were just beta testing VDI, a virtual desktop interface. Whatever happened with that pilot, are you guys on the VDI now? Give me a sense of where that's at.
We've rolled out VDI, so that allows us to have a single desktop image. And as a result, we can push out the latest versions of the browsers, Firefox, Chrome, and Internet Explorer. And so that's helped us a lot in terms of allowing us to be more focused on other things in terms of actually application development and things like that, as opposed to having to individually update each of the different desktops that we used to have. There's some cases where VDI doesn't fit everything. If you do a lot of processing intensive calculations or very graphic intensive, you still need to have a standalone computer. But that's now a much smaller subset than what we used to have. VDI also allows us to then look at, when we move to the cloud, can we actually do desktop as a service through a cloud provider as opposed to having to maintain it ourselves?
And now I know we're going to talk about cloud in a little bit, but is this the move in the VDI is always the kind of the precursor to the bigger move, but is desktop as a service something that is among your considerations?
Oh, yes, definitely desktop as a service. Actually, my goal that I've always had is to get FCC out of the business of trying to maintain its own infrastructure. I think that then extends to having to maintain its own desktops and everything like that. That can be done with much better scale by larger organizations than the FCC.
Do you have concern that the idea and what you're calling this is not necessarily seat management, but it is the same concept where you don't own anything. Does that concern you? Because there's been challenges, whether it's ATF was in seat management for a while and they got out, NASA was in it, they got out. The biggest one, of course, is the Navy Marine Corps Intranet, they got out. Does that concern you that all these people are getting out, yet you're trying to get in?
So I think if I look at what happened with those other events, and I don't have all the details, it was probably a case of early adopter and at the same time, private sector companies were not as far along in terms of what they could provide. Definitely when you do virtual desktop, you need to make sure you have enough bandwidth, and you need to make sure you understand your network topology enough so that you're removing any barriers to the bandwidth. But I look at the where we're going, both in terms of mobility and then ultimately with the Internet of Everything, is quite probable 2 or 3 years from now for any organization, private sector or public sector, more than 80% of the devices in your organization you won't own. And so in some respects, I want to go to a model where it's kind of like Starbucks, which is the local area network that you actually plug into will take care of. The Wi-Fi in a building, however, is much more like Starbucks, which is you go to Starbucks, you hope the Wi-Fi is secure, you hope you're doing a good job on your machine to secure it too, but in general, everyone's using it. And so similarly, in the workplace here, we do have a Wi-Fi. It's public Wi-Fi because we do have commission meetings at the FCC. And that public Wi-Fi, if you do decide to use your FCC device, you're using a secure tunnel, whether it's through VDI or some other sort of secure tunnel app to then hit the FCC. And so in some respects, VDI is not just about trying to have us focus on things beyond just trying to keep hardware and software up to date, which is getting increasingly hard to keep everything up to date just because of the rate at which things are changing. But it also allows us to do secure tunnels to the FCC for infrastructure using your own device if you do bring your own device to work.
One thing that's key to any seat management is the service level agreements. What are you learning from maybe whether it's happening in the private sector or are you talking to public sector people about making sure your SLAs are where they need to be?
So the biggest thing that we've recognized with SLAs is the interdependencies between the services that are being provided and the network topology that you have. And if they're separate, you need to have a really good understanding of the complications that network topology might provide that are not linked to what the service is itself providing. That's part of why we still have the goal that I've said for a while, which is we want to get all our servers off-site to a commercial managed service provider. Just because after 20 years, the network topology, as you can imagine, at the FCC is a bit complicated.
All right, well, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we can catch up on one other older priority, and then we'll jump into your new ones, which I think we're already marbling in a little bit. My guest today is David Bray, the Federal Communication Commission's Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Okay, what are you wearing right now?
Nothing.
That's right. So mommy's going to teach you how to dress yourself. Underwear always comes first, name tag at the back, then pants, then shirt. Get the first button in the right hole or you have to start all over. Socks go in first, then shoes, right on right, left on left. With shoelaces, just take the ends, cross them over, switch the loops, the rabbit goes down the hole, pull tight, and you're left with bunny ears. Got it? Why are your pants on your head?
Most parenting is hard to do in just 2 minutes. But 2 minutes twice a day, making sure they brush their teeth, is easier, and it could help save them from a lifetime of tooth pain. Visit 2min2x.org to find out more. A message from the Partnership for Healthy Mouths, Healthy Lives, and the Ag Council.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest today is David Bray, the FCC Chief Information Officer. David, before break, we're talking about some older priorities. One other old one that you mentioned back in 2014, the last time we were on the show, is the possibility of BYOD, bring your own device. Now, what's the status of that idea? Very few agencies have actually moved into that realm of BYOD, but there's still a lot of interest. Is the FCC adopting, you know, mobility and BYOD? Give me a sense of where that's at.
We do have a BYOD. It's in beta, and that allows people to either bring in their own device and use our VDI, virtual desktop interface, if they want to, or they can also use, we're using a GOOD as a client as well for email purposes, which for a lot of purposes here at the FCC, because a lot of what we do is email and documents, it's sufficient. We also are just wrapping out a rollout of Office 365. It is on their public cloud. And per our colleagues at Microsoft, they said it's actually been twice the speed they've ever done a rollout. It was partly just because we wanted to get it done this summer. But that also then allows you to use O365, not just in the workplace, but if you want to use it at home through either the web browser interface or whatever the case might be, it is the same account no matter where you go.
And when you talk about BYOD, are we talking about just mobile devices? Are you talking about laptops or yes to it all?
Yes to all. So if you bring in your own laptop, you're not connecting to the LAN, obviously, because we want to limit the LAN to only devices we control, but you can connect it to Wi-Fi. And again, from that Wi-Fi, you would do a secure tunnel if you needed to touch anything here at the FCC. Same thing for tablets, same thing for mobile devices. So really, it's more the thing with BYOD that we found now is people asking, do they get reimbursed? Do they not get reimbursed? That's actually not my choice. I just do the IT, and it's more of a question with HR in terms of, is that something that is reimbursed if you're actually consuming the bandwidth on your own device?
And have you guys made that decision yet, or is that still in process of being looked at?
Yeah, that's still in process of being looked at. But again, it's something that I look at it, we provide the choices, and then it's more of a human resources discussion with the chief financial officer as to whether or not that happens.
Do people seem to care, or are they happy to bring their own device?
So I think a lot of people are taking part, and especially because there are some new devices that come out that allow you to separate your personal from your professional on the devices with different technologies. I think it's a very small group that's actually talking about whether or not they get reimbursed. I think the biggest thing people like is that they can telework anywhere. And that's the biggest gain. And so we have seen, especially in the last 6 months at the FCC, more and more supervisors, as long as they know what the employee is doing, also approving telework.
Are you seeing a larger number of people coming in from outside using the secure tunnel? And are you set up to handle all that?
But we're looking at actually planning as if every day was a snowstorm. So that's where we want to go. Again, with a limited budget, we haven't been able to do it overnight. But what we plan to do over the next 4 to 5 months is basically upgrade our VDI infrastructure such that if every day was a snowstorm and if everyone was teleworking, we could still handle it.
And when you do have a snowstorm, do you tell your provider, hey, expect more people?
Well, yeah, so we would. The good thing is, again, we went to Office 365 in terms of the public cloud, so that's actually not on FCC's infrastructure at all. And, of course, Microsoft, we're like a drop in the bucket to them. So at least for email and for documents, we could, as of today, if there was a COOP event or if everyone had to work from home for whatever reason, hurricane, because they're actually on part of the public cloud for Microsoft, they could work anywhere, anytime, and it would actually be no degradation of service.
Let me switch gears a little bit and talk about some new priorities. These are some old ones we talked about earlier. What are you hoping to get done over the next 6 or 9 months?
I think continuing where we've already been, which is to basically get out of the business of trying to maintain our own infrastructure. There are some things that can go straight to the cloud, like our consumer help desk. We're looking at, for the next fiscal year 16, looking at all the different licensing applications that FCC runs. A lot of them are more than 10 years old. And looking for a cloud-based platform, and it may be one or two, because it may be that one platform doesn't fit everything, we'll see. But basically to move the business logic and processes present in those licensing systems to one or more software as a service or platform as a service options, as well as extract the data from those legacy systems so that you can go back and look at old licensing in that. Again, this is consistent with what we've already done with Office 365, which is our goal probably in 2 years, if I wanted to be ambitious. If I wanted to give us a grace period, I'd say in 3 years. But really, if I wanted to be ambitious, is that we are 100% public cloud. I recognize that this may not fit for every organization. Again, FCC is only 750 people, maybe another 500 contractors. And so at that size, it does not make sense for me to try and either stand up a private cloud or try to do something at a scale that I really can't do at 2,250 people. So licensing systems, we're also looking at tracking systems. FCC has a lot of different tracking systems as well. When we talked last time about 18 months ago, I said we had 207 systems. The good news is we've gotten that list down to now about 102 through a combination of both retiring some systems, moving some to the cloud in bulk, and also merging a few. I'd like to be able to say a year and a half, 2 years from now, that we're down to only 50 or 40 systems. The ultimate goal, really what I'm looking at is, just to give you a context, 200 servers, which we currently have, still remaining at the FCC, over 390 different applications, and that's software applications that may be running on those servers. Most of them are not ones we wrote, fortunately, but some of them are. And the average age of 10 years. So that's 200 times 390 times 10. You get to about 790,000 units of what I call entropy. That's just not scalable for the world we're going into. And so really what I want to get to instead is having one common way of logging into public cloud systems using your HSPD-12 badge as a second form of authentication, in addition to username and password, at most 8 different platforms. So obviously Office 365 is one we've already done. We've looked at Zendesk. That's what we're doing for our consumer help desk. There's probably going to be another at most 5 or 6. So that would get it to 8. And of course, then I'm counting that those public cloud providers are going to keep their software up to date because they obviously have many more customers than we do, and equally keep their cybersecurity up to date too. So that's really just 8 units of entropy as opposed to almost 800,000 units of entropy. And that's rough, that's math, it's not precise, but what that shows is we're trying to simplify and defragment the complexity that basically grew up over the last 20 years.
A lot to go over there. Let me take a step back. When you talk about 8 different platforms, we're talking about not necessarily 8 networks, and we're not necessarily talking about 8 servers. You're talking about what platform is the licensing system on or the tracking system. And right now there's multiple variations. There's multiple, you may have a Unix, a Linux, and a Windows, and they don't necessarily talk well. Do I have that right in terms of the way you're describing this?
Right. So it's both in terms of collapsing the amount of software and hardware platforms, but in some respects, it's even just abstracting it in the sense that I'm going to a commercial vendor that will maintain it. And so I don't care what servers or hardware or software they're doing. It's just what do they present me to then replicate the business logic that I need to in there. And then there's also the speed advantage. I think what the cloud really gets people, because I think sometimes people think the cloud is cheaper, and sometimes it is, but a lot of times it's not. But really what the cloud gets me is if tomorrow either the Congress or the administration says there needs to be a change in how FCC does X, licensing or whatever it might be. If we had written the code ourselves, then we'd have to figure out where in the code are these processes embodied, where can we change it, we have to test it, and it could very easily be 6 to 8 weeks before we get it rolled out. Whereas if it's on a platform as a service or software as a service public cloud that's offering this function to a lot of people, all we have to do is go to where in that business logic are we instantiating whatever that process is, change it consistent with the new law or the new policy that's been issued, that could probably be done in less than an hour. And so instead of taking 6 to 8 weeks and spending the amount of money to change something in 6 to 8 weeks, it's about the speed of getting it done in an hour or two.
The public cloud, when you mention it, it's interesting because very few CIOs will say, I'm going to go only to the public cloud. Mostly I hear hybrid, mostly I hear private, or as someone described it as, it's a public cloud in a private area. So meaning that Microsoft or Google or Amazon or whomever is kind of walls it off. Why are you confident in the public cloud the way you describe it versus these other descriptions of hybrid or public-private mixture?
So I think it just goes back to, again, we're small and we have a limited budget, so I can't quite afford private cloud. And it would not make sense that I try to apply all my resources to that, given that at most, again, my IT staff is, if you include contractors, government-wise, it's 50 people, contractors about 325. So security-wise, we probably have 30, 35 people. But even then, 30 to 35 people doing cybersecurity, while that's great for an agency of our size, that's more than, you know, that's a lot. That's still not the same in terms of what an enterprise software as a service, platform as a service person has. They probably have hundreds. And they, again, the incentive model for a public cloud is you want to make sure everything is secure. You want to make sure that you have trust in terms of what your customers are receiving and doing. And so it aligns perfectly in that they're going to do everything they can to make sure it is secure, to make sure it is up to date. And I like that. And so as a result, because I'm small, why not sort of take the advantage of the economy of scale that I can get by working with them?
Do you feel like the FCC also has a benefit that you're not holding as much sensitive or classified data as, and you can pick your agency, Justice, Treasury, DHS, whomever?
I guess. I mean, we do have that advantage, but I would say that probably every organization has things they probably don't want to have go out. And it's even then just a perception. So even if the data itself is not highly sensitive, just a perception that something went out can also be challenging. I would look at, in the case of CIA going with AWS, I mean, clearly they're willing to actually go to a cloud. It's not a public cloud, but they're willing to go to cloud technology. I would just say if done right, with the right protocols in place, the right encryption, I do feel like public cloud has a lot of advantage. Again, make sure you pick a big player, and make sure you pick a big player that has something on the line in which they are going to invest the appropriate resources to focus on making sure the cloud is both scalable but also resilient and is up as much as possible.
Good advice. A lot of CIOs, I think, are paying attention. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll jump into some other priorities. My guest today is David Bray, the Federal Communications Commission's Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest today is David Bray, the Federal Communications Commission's Chief Information Officer. We're talking a lot about public, private, hybrid clouds. How do you rationalize the fact that, yes, Amazon or Google or IBM or whomever have a profit motive around security, but they also, you're not that big. You're not going to spend a ton of money with them. They still may say, you know, not that they're going to do bad with security, but how are you assured that your data will be protected at the way it needs to be protected?
First part is you need to have standards. And so some of that's coming from FedRAMP, and that sort of sets the first baseline for what's needed. And then you need to look at what additional protections you might need based on the sensitivity of the data. And that then you would apply the appropriate NIST 853, Rev 4, whatever else needs to be put on it. In terms of public cloud versus private or hybrid cloud. I think it's worth stepping back and saying, let's be honest and actually say anything on the internet, you can't guarantee is going to ever be 100% secure. And if you assume that, then the question is, if I have a limited budget, which I do, what is the best bang for the buck that I can get, given that I can't guarantee 100% security? And so with hybrid or private cloud, you're really in it for yourself, and you're going to have a lot of responsibility. Now, that also gives you a lot of control, but it also means you might miss something, given that any organization is going to have, I'm a big believer that any organization, any individual is going to have blind spots in terms of what they're going to miss. The advantage of going with a very large organization, the economy of scale, aside from the fact that they can spend much more on security than I can because they're a size, is they probably also have a diversity of thought. They're probably running red teams and red teams on their red teams to see if they can actually penetrate what they've already produced. And I'm sure there's going to be a case where public cloud or private or hybrid cloud, yes, it's penetrable, and yes, mistakes are going to be made. What I'm much more interested in is a public cloud provider, if they're large, has every incentive to avoid the appearance of a breach, and whether it's from a small organization like us or an even larger one. And so I think that's important. But then two, it's really about how rapidly you can detect that something's gone on, how rapidly can you contain it, and how rapidly can you respond to it. And I imagine, again, if you're a large organization, you have teams 24/7, which may not be affordable to smaller organizations. And then finally, good design, again, going back to what comes from NIST and those 853 Rev4 guidances and FedRAMP, it really should include encryption at rest, encryption at transit. It really should include containment policies to make sure that if you get access, you don't get access to everything. And if I tie it to your HSPD-12 badge, then I can also make it attribute-based access control with a second factor. So I do think a conversation needs to be had across organizations, whether it's in the private sector or the public sector, which is, you know, we don't expect in the real world, I can guarantee something is going to be 100% safe. You know, you and I are having this conversation in this building, but there's nothing that prevents someone from trying to crash a car into it or trying to blow it up, or hopefully it won't happen, low probability event, although it would be very interesting to be in an interview with you as we blow up. But anyway, that said, we don't expect the real world to be 100% safe. So why do we expect it in the digital world? And if we get past the fact that we can't have 100% security anywhere, then what can we do to try and make it much more of a risk-based approach and manage that risk, again, with the idea that I don't have infinite funds. I really can't go to the Congress and say I need even more and more and more money. But I also need to show to the Congress with the funds I've got, I've done the best diligence I can to try and take the appropriate steps to secure what we have.
The main piece of that, and this goes back to an earlier part of our conversation, is the service level agreements. What model are you guys using, or how are you ensuring that your SLAs, again, you're going to own your data, the security needs to be this many levels? How are you making sure that that's the right pieces are in place there?
So the procurement piece and the SL piece is definitely where the metal meets the road in some respects for what we're doing here, in that you have to spend a lot of time up front. In fact, I probably think of my time, even though I say my job is 80% people, 20% technology, probably 40% of that people time is actually trying to do the procurement right and doing HR right. And so we have many different eyes take a look at it to make sure we don't miss anything. There are no standard contracts out there at the moment. That would be nice. In fact, I would love it if GSA was to step up and actually have cloud services on demand with pre-written SLAs or even SLA templates that we could reuse that included the right language in terms of security, and you could pick, you know, the different levels or maybe things that you do for just completely unclassified versus law enforcement sensitive versus other things. And then equally, there should, like you said, be out clauses that say, I'm so confident in what I'm going to provide to you as a service that in the event that you ever decide to exit, there is an off-ramp and the data is delivered to you in this format. The other thing that I think a lot of agencies are discovering, and we're discovering and making sure we're following up on, is you need to make sure you write into the contracts for the cloud provider what rate and what level of detail is shared in terms of if a security event happens, or even if it's just a hardware or software error, because maybe it's not a security event, just something's going wrong. Instead of, like, we see something wrong, we'll get back to you in 48 or 72 hours, you want to have more information at a faster rate going into your network security operations center.
Well, I think that if you can get these contracts written well, you'll get a lot of people who are interested, and maybe GSA will take your contracts and make them the standard. And, you know, it's all about category management now. It's not GSA doing everything. Let me shift over to the workforce, because I think that's an issue that every agency is also struggling with. And it's a combination of trying to find the right talented people who have the skill sets, whether it's project management or program management or cyber, as well as getting people in that will stay for a decent long period of time. Talk about your workforce challenges and the types of skill sets you're most interested in bringing in.
I think the biggest thing when I think about the workforce is there's currently a message that the best and the brightest don't want to work for government. And I pause when I hear that statement, because the first thing I would say is I actually don't want to use the word of just government. I think we're actually in the business of public service. Public service is first and foremost about serving the public. And in fact, the public can actually be a participant. They're not just a recipient of services. The example of the FCC speed test app that we made open source, that was actually the public opting in if they wanted to actually be a part of informing how fast broadband connections were. So I think we need to think about how do we involve the public, not just as a receiver of services, but involving them. That can help sort of offload work that we previously had to do as government professionals. The second is I do actually look at it as partnerships. When we involve contractors, it's not just we're paying you money to get something done, although that's obviously at one level, it's a transaction. It really is our fates are shared. If this goes well, for example, when we're rolling out a new service or if we're doing something new in terms of our infrastructure, if it goes well, they should get as much credit, if not more, than we do because they were partners in the effort. Equally, if it goes wrong, then we also share the credit that went wrong. And so it's involving the private sector partners. So finally, you get to the idea of, well, what about government professionals? So with our entrepreneurs and our change agents, we have been very intentional about recognizing that change agents and entrepreneurs can be either government professionals or contractors. And there are certain things, obviously, that a government professional can do that a contractor can't. But equally, contractors allow us to get people through whoever we're procuring them from in a faster rate in some respects than HR. In fact, that's another area where I would love to have help, which is standardized templates for hiring so that we don't have to each time go through a new job categorization and what level does this spec out at, and is it a 12, is it a 13, whatever the case might be. So faster hiring is definitely something I would love. But what we've looked at in terms of is really, if I give people autonomy, if I give them measurable progress, and if I give them a meaningful mission, which we have no shortage of, and if I can overcome the stereotype, which is supposedly the best and the brightest don't want to work for public service, when in fact I think we won't get them all, clearly, but I think we can get a lot. And as long as we can make it easy for you to on-ramp on, whether as a contractor or as a government professional, and then also with the expectation that I think looking at Gen Y, and then I guess there's Gen Z down the road after them, they're probably not going to work in the same role for more than 2 or 3 years, and that's okay, which is different than what it used to be with the boomers. The baby boomers was a model of you sign up and you do government service for the next 30 or 40 years. I look at my own career, I pretty much change jobs every 2 or 3 years. I've done private sector, I've done nonprofits. I have no idea what I'll do next. In fact, right now I'm still at the FCC, but wherever in my mind, where the biggest need is where I'll go, that will help address it. But I do think we right now don't have people standing up and saying, it's not about government, it's about public service first and foremost. And then two, it is actually a noble calling. You know, you'll never have an IPO, we'll never have stock options here, but at the same time, you can find a place to be of service, to build a team, and be part of something larger than yourself.
The hiring piece is something that the government has struggled with. What are you doing around hiring to kind of ease that burden on the FCC?
Right now, we're limited in the amount of hires we can do, but I'm trying to make the case, if I can cut our budget by a significant amount, can I then use those funds to hire people? So that's one thing we're looking at, because we don't necessarily have any more slots. Second is I'm looking strategically at when do I do a government hire versus do I turn to a contractor and say, can you provide something that provides this resource with the expectation that it's not going to be a job that's beyond 9 months or 10 months? And so it's just those choices and trade-offs. The other thing I'm just very intentional about is I tell the team, I said, this is really one team, one mission. In fact, we just had a meeting this morning, and we are in the midst of actually this is probably the busiest August that I have seen in quite a while at the FCC, and it's because we're in the midst of doing several things. But I said, you know, there are these rare moments in which people from diverse backgrounds, whether they be vendors and vendors of all different types, contractors, government people with different skill sets, people all come together. And I do feel like right now we've managed, many thanks to different people we've had. We have Martha Johnson here. We have Tony Summerlin here. We have Karen Evans here. We have one of the most diverse teams that has finally hit its stride in terms of what it's delivering. And that's a joy in and of itself. I think that actually attracts people and it retains people because they do want to be a part of that team mentality, because we often want to be a belonging to something. We actually, 3 months ago, it was quite interesting. So every 6 months or so, I just sort of have a town hall where I meet with the team and I say, I'm just going to listen. How are we doing? And I'm not going to cast judgment. I'm just going to let people tell me. And sometimes, you know, if we had done this 18 months ago, I think I told you we probably had about 15 or 20% that were on board. Another 40% were waiting to see. 40% wanted to go back the way it was. Just 3 months ago, we were now at the tipping point where we had about 60% felt quite good. They recognized that there were still some things we needed to address, but 60% felt quite good. Another 20% getting there, and it was very small percentage wanted to go back the way things were. And one person characterized it best. They said it was like Thanksgiving. And I said, how so? Because, again, I was only asking questions. I wasn't. And I said, how so? And I said, it's like Thanksgiving in a sense that you have your family. Your family might be a little bit dysfunctional, but your family's together, and everybody's hopeful. And they're also under best behavior. And so when that happens, especially given where it was when I came in here about 2 years ago, and that was not the same morale stance I came into, it's almost a joy to go to work. I won't say I work for free because I don't think that's allowed by law that I can work for free, but to create that and to feel that, and then at the same time know what you're doing is actually peeling back 20 years of added complexity and added burden, and that it will probably hopefully put FCC on a much more cost-effective stance, that I hopefully will attract talent. That's partly why I do Twitter, to share that message and see who we can find. It's also partly why I do host about every 2 or 3 weeks an informal happy hour, just to see who else can come. But ideally, at the end of the day, I want this to be much more than just the FCC. I want it to be a message that all across government, and it's not just limited to 18F or USDS, it's actually all across all different agencies, you can find meaning and purpose in public service.
Let's take a quick break. We come back. We have a few more things to touch upon, including cybersecurity. My guest today is David Bray, the FCC Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest today is David Bray, the Federal Communication Commission's Chief Information Officer. Dave, before break, we talked a lot about workforce and the challenges you guys are having. One of the big areas around workforce and just challenges more generally, of course, is cybersecurity. And you kind of wearing two hats when it comes to cybersecurity. Let's start with the first one. That's the FCC hat. You mentioned two-factor authentication. You mentioned back-end attribute exchange and roles and responsibilities. Give me a sense. In the wake of the OPM breach, in the wake of the cyber sprint across government, all these stories and discussions on cybersecurity, what are you doing around securing your networks, your data, to ensure that you're not the next victim of another cyber breach?
So I think that's probably every CIO's worst nightmare. In terms of what we're doing, we're continuing on the plan we had, which was to reduce complexity, because complicated networks are probably the biggest risk when it comes to cybersecurity. That's why we've done our VDI. That's why we're moving to get out of the business of hosting servers ourselves and the infrastructure that came with it, and trying to get off legacy systems, because some of those legacy systems are running legacy code, and who knows what's in there. Beyond that, as you said, two-factor authentication, and then identifying. I think the key thing is that all organizations should identify what are particularly sensitive data holdings that they have, because there may be things you want to do beyond just the blanket security for everything that you want to do even more focused security on. And there may even be some cases where that data is no longer needed, and so maybe it should be archived with NARA or something like that. But you know, it's a question of what are the appropriate things in terms of the risk applied to data. And while I know NIST 853 and FIPS 199, they do ask at the creation of a system to think about what are the risks associated with the creation of it. It might be worth revisiting, because maybe after 10 years, the data that was initially conceived in the creation of this is no longer the case, or maybe a risk has been created. So we're being very intentional. We've actually polled all the bureaus and offices in terms of the data they collect, and then from there trying to identify what things we need to focus on the most. Again, it's a question of how just do you avoid, you know, the fact that you can't guarantee anything's going to be 100% secure, but you can at least raise the barrier and put in place the appropriate safeguards.
One thing that gets a lot of attention is the idea of encryption, data encryption. There was the cyber sprint as well, talked about two-factor authentication. When I came into the building, the FCC building on 12th Street, one of the things I noticed was the security guards were not looking at people's passes as flash passes. So it seems to me you guys have attached your physical access security with your logical access security. Are you there with your HSPD-12, at least for the getting onto the network, getting into the building piece?
Getting into the building, yes. We actually are currently in beta for the rest of our systems. And so that is linked to simplifying our networks that we need to do. And so once we complete the move of our servers to a commercial managed provider, then that will allow us to complete the beta that we're doing for HSPD-12. So it'll actually be tied to that.
And currently right now, is there concern in the post-cyber sprint world that do you need a second factor somehow, whether it's not the HSPD-12 card, but have you done something to say, okay, how can we upgrade our security? And I know there's some sensitivity, so maybe at a high level.
Right. So we've been using a second factor, not just HSPD-12, but whether it be RSA tokens or things like that, so you can have a one-time password. I do think that's needed for certain data sets. We've been doing it for a while. We've been following what's been going on with the Cyber Sprint. We're actually a non-CFO Act agency, but we've been following the guidance because the guidance is great, and actually have a lot of respect for what Tony Scott is putting out. So we're definitely watching and moving forward as quickly as it can. I think the biggest hurdle we have is just there's so many threats out there, which is the one that you should focus on the most. And that's the challenge of everything that a CIO does. And so I think the best thing any CIO can do for any organization, private sector or public sector, is make sure you're having a conversation with your chief executive officer if you're in the private sector, or with your secretary or your chairman, chairwoman, if the case might be. Have that conversation with the non-IT sets about the state of risk that are out there, about the data sets they have. And it may very well be that then the non-IT leadership may actually identify and say, well, either A, we need to carve out more of a focus on these specific things, or maybe we don't need to collect this data. But it really needs to be a conversation with the mission, not just limited to what IT is doing.
The other hat you're wearing is you were named a fellow for Eisenhower Fellowship, and your focus is around cybersecurity. You've done some amazing travel over the last year. Talk a little bit about that fellowship and what's ahead for you over the next, you know, 3 or 6 months.
Back in late January and through the month of February, I was fortunate enough to be an Eisenhower Fellow, which was basically 5 weeks overseas in Taiwan and then in Australia, meeting with their ministers of defense, justice, and communications, as well as private sector industry representatives. Got to meet with presidents of several companies and really have a conversation, in particular, focus on the Internet of Everything. Because I think the Internet of Everything, one, we don't realize how transformative this will be in just in terms of the exponential growth. So I know a lot of people are looking forward to cars that drive themselves. I am too. But then it raises an interesting question, because we see almost on a daily basis in the private sector and in the public sector stories of cyber breaches. And those are the only ones in which there is an incentive for the private sector organization, or there's pressure on the public sector organization to reveal it. So if that's the case, that, you know, huge opportunity with the Internet of Everything, but we're also seeing challenges in terms of TCP/IP, Internet Protocol, and just how do we do cybersecurity, how do we balance that? And that's just one aspect. The other conversation I had a lot of conversations with in Taiwan and Australia about was privacy. Because personally, I'd like to think that we can have both privacy and security. That's not an either or. And actually suggesting some options. One might be, can you put consumers in charge of what data they share with different platforms? Right now, you have to log into whether it's Google or Facebook or LinkedIn, and they control the privacy settings. And if they change their privacy settings, then you have to go back and whether you accept the terms or not. But what if instead you had an open source agent on your behalf? The code was open source, so you can make sure it knows back doors, and you express your preferences much more like a conversation like we're having here. So someone might say, would you be willing to share your data with company X in the event of a health emergency? And you might say yes or no. Would you be willing to share it in a car crash? Yes or no. And so you're making choices based in context, because I think a lot of privacy is not one or zero. It's not yes or no. A lot of it is in the context of something happening. And that's interesting, because the Internet of Everything allows you to actually have a better understanding of the context.
Fascinating stuff. I know we could talk longer, but unfortunately we are out of time. My guest today has been David Bray, Federal Communication Commission's Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you've been listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. David, thank you so much for taking the time to join us, and you will continue the conversation on August 26th at 2 p.m. when you join us for an online chat on federalnewsradio.com. Thank you for today, and thank you for the online chat.
Thanks for having me, Jason, and look forward to August the 26th.
You've been listening to Ask the Chief Information Officer. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, Ask the CIO, Thursday mornings at 10:30, only on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.